It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the high price of healthcare is driving people to go to some great lengths to get covered. We'll talk to a reporter who's been talking to some of these families. First, Governor Walker unveiled a plan yesterday that would eventually close the Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake youth facilities in northern Wisconsin. These detention centers have been controversial for the last few years as allegations of abuse have been made public. It's a move that advocates have been calling for over those years, but the plan would still need to be approved in the state legislature. And some lawmakers say it moves too slowly to fix the ongoing problem. Jeffrey Roman is with us now. He's an organizer for Youth Justice Milwaukee. Jeffrey, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, you've been following the what's been going on at Lincoln Hills for a while. What was your reaction when you heard this announcement yesterday?
Well, I think our initial reaction was shock. We were not expecting the administration and Governor Walker to make such an announcement that he did yesterday. And so we were shocked. So after our initial response, we got to moving and we got connecting with our network. And overwhelmingly, I think the response is that this is a win for Wisconsin. This is a win for the advocates and the young people here in Wisconsin who have been calling for Lincoln Hills and Copper Lakes to be closed and for an end to the abuse and the outdated practices at Lincoln Hills and Copper Lakes.
Talk about the advantages of this change. This is something that you and others have been calling for a while, ending this facility up north in Wisconsin where basically all of these offenders end up, young offenders, and moving them into smaller sites around the state. What advantages are there to that?
I think the immediate advantage is that young people who are involved or have engagement with the juvenile criminal justice system, that in order for them to really have the chance to rehabilitate, they'll have a chance to have closer access to their families, which we know is a key ingredient or component to rehabilitation. I think the more immediate advantage is this opportunity now brings the opportunity for those young people, those voices, their parents, and the broader community to be engaged in planning and decision-making for reimagining and revisioning what the youth justice system looks like in Wisconsin.
Are you concerned about what these smaller detention centers end up looking like? If they're mini Lincoln Hills, maybe not much is going to change?
That is definitely a concern. What we don't want is that for the five or six regional facilities that is being proposed to be created, that they replicate the conditions and the environments that's happening in the larger Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake facilities right now. We are opposed to that. Our advocacy and our response is that this is a good starting point. The idea for smaller regional kind of facilities is a starting point to have a conversation and to engage dialogue and input. But our advocacy is that those facilities need to be smaller. They need to be more trauma-informed and therapeutic settings, and that they shouldn't be more than 15 young people per the facility.
A lot of people have talked about the model that's in place in Missouri, the state of Missouri. Mm-hmm. We've talked to you about that before. Can you talk about what we could learn in Wisconsin from Missouri if this actually ends up happening and as these smaller facilities get opened?
Well, yeah, so I think the Missouri model, which is a similar model in that there are smaller facilities, but I think the most important piece is that the Missouri model really incorporates the therapeutic kind of cognitive behavior kind of practices and approaches and the training for the facilities, the individuals and personnel of those facilities. And so there's an informed, trauma-informed training and kind of environment that's spread throughout those facilities and those smaller regional things. And so I think that's the biggest standout piece of what we're seeing in Missouri is that those are critical pieces of the interventions in Missouri.
Stepping away from the youthful offenders here for a moment, part of this plan would involve, and this is something that's been proposed by Democrats and now is in the governor's plan, taking Lincoln Hills, converting it into an adult facility. The current adult prison system is overcrowded in Wisconsin right now. What do you think of that part of the plan?
Well, so I think, as in the youth side, I just think that our over-reliance on incarceration in our correction system is an outdated, failed model, whether that's on the adult side or the youth side. We have way too many people, whether they're younger or old, going into our prison system. And so while we are excited and glad that the changes are being made on the youth side, I don't see much progress happening on the adult side.
We're talking to Jeffrey Roman with Youth Justice Milwaukee, talking about the governor's announcement yesterday of a plan that, if approved, would close the Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake youth detention facilities, turn them into adult prisons, but then start up smaller facilities around the state for youth in the prison system. Jeffrey, are you starting to think about where these smaller facilities should be around the state?
Well, I think, yeah, we know that there are certain areas in the city where, or certain areas in the state where the majority of young people that are sent to Lincoln Hills and Copper Lakes are being sent to. In our opinion, that those need to be the areas where our administration, the governor's administration, needs to target and begin to work with those communities to really define the appropriate level of resources that need to go into those facilities. Again, we are advocating that those facilities are much, much smaller and that they are informed by the input of the community and those who are impacted by the system.
I want to talk to you about the timing. The governor's plan would really not kick into the legislature until next year's budget planning session, and then it would take a while for it to actually be put into practice if it passed as part of a budget. You have legislators, some Democrats, but also, as we've been hearing in the news, some Republicans saying, hey, we've got bills in the legislature now. We could get moving on this faster. The governor saying he might be on board with that. What do you think of the dueling timelines there?
Yeah, we are all for expediting the process, and where there are opportunities available to be able to expedite this process and to work with our legislators and the current bills that are going forward to make sure that young people get the supports that they need immediately and to reimagine and reform the system, we are all on board with making sure that happens, again, with the input from those who are most impacted.
I want to broaden our conversation a little bit now, Jeffrey. Ideally, of course, the youth who go into the incarceration system wouldn't go there in the first place. We'd figure out solutions to this problem before we got to that stage. What do you think needs to happen on that end?
Yeah, so I think there are a lot of things that need to happen. First and foremost, our local judges and circuit court judges have a lot of discretion, a lot of sway in what happens to young people and whether or not they go into our correctional facilities. And so first and foremost, I think our judges and our local leaders and our local leaders need to take a stance and realize the conditions that our young people are facing when they are sentenced to the Lincoln Hills and Copper Lakes, and especially being so far away, and really rely on the resources that do exist in our community to be able to make sure young people get the supports they need as they need them.
We had a judge from Dane County on the show a few weeks back, and he said when young people come before him in the courtroom, he tries to do something a little different. Among other things, he tries to help them come up with their own solutions, figure out from them what they're going to need to keep themselves out of the system, basically. As part of your work organizing there in Milwaukee, do you try to do that as well?
Absolutely, and as we are working in with our local judges and having conversation and sharing research and evidence of various effective practices across the country, one of the interventions that we are seeing is that judges are really taking the time and being more thoughtful about the orders that they do, and they're working with not only the young people but their families and the community that those young people are coming from to define or to develop the appropriate conditions for their being in society.
Can you talk about families a little more now? Part of the goal here in moving away from Lincoln Hills, which is north of Wausau, to facilities around the state, maybe one, probably one in the Milwaukee area. How much of a difference does that make, having access to a family for an incarcerated youth?
Oh, it makes a world of a difference. We know, and all the research that we've been looking at and the reports that we are looking at is saying that young people who have access to their families and the resources of their community have a higher chance of rehabilitating, have a higher chance of not recidivating once they have been released from the system. And makes our communities much safer. The access to families and community is a very, very key component to rehabilitation and one that we are really, really advocating that our judges and our system leaders will allow our families to be more engaged and closer to those young people.
Now, when we were talking to that judge I mentioned in Dane County, he said in some cases, tragically, a kid might come before him in court, and there's not an adult who will respond to that call for one reason or another in that family situation. Is part of the solution having counseling for the families of these youth who end up in the system to bring them back into the equation?
Absolutely. Counseling and additional supports. We know that a lot of young people that have interfaced with the system, a lot of them, unfortunately, or many of them, unfortunately, come from environments where their families need a lot of additional supports as well and are seeking and searching for supports. And so we believe that in addition to working with young people and make sure that they have the supports they need, a critical piece in doing that is making sure that we're working with their families and providing the supports that they need as well to be supports to their young people.
Looking at Milwaukee from the outside, especially from the suburban areas, though, it seems like in some cases people have lost faith in Milwaukee. They see the rising homicide numbers that happened in 2015 and 2016. I haven't seen the final numbers for 2017 yet. Do you, though, feel optimistic that there are things going on there that are moving in the right direction for youth and for crime rates?
I feel optimistic because I see those things happening on a daily basis. A part of my job is to make sure that I'm identifying and working and scaling and supporting the individuals and leaders and organizations and efforts that are here working to drive positive change for young people in Milwaukee and across the rest of the state, particularly in the greater Milwaukee region. We are aware of mentor services and counseling programs and organizations that are working day in and day out with young people who have given additional supports and investment could scale those resources to be able to serve many more young people in our community that unfortunately fall victim to the system.
Can you name some names of those organizations and talk a little about the work they do? Because I think it's easy to hear a lot of the bad news and not see the good efforts going on behind the headlines.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There are a number of organizations that do great work. The ones that come to the top of my mind who really work with this population are organizations like the Running Rebels Community Organization, who work with not only first-time juvenile offenders, but our chronic and serious offending juvenile offenders, and work with them doing mentoring and case management and intensive care kind of support programming and provide them outlets to be able to not only develop their character and address things in the community, but also to engage their families. There are a number of organizations. There are programs, Heal the Hood, that's working with young people in their communities and families across the community to make sure that they're engaging and giving them the resources and opportunities to collaborate and work with one another. And so there are a number of other ones, but those are the two that come to the top of mind, and there are many, many others here in Milwaukee and around the county that are doing the same thing.
If there are people who are listening and they're in the Milwaukee area and thinking, hey, I've got some time or expertise or something of value I could offer, are these organizations and your own, for that matter, looking for volunteers?
Absolutely. And I believe they and others are always looking for ways that the broader community to engage and support not only the work of those organizations, but the work of the young people that patronize those organizations. And so whether it's Running Rebels or the Urban Underground or the Operation Dream or the list goes on and on, I'm sure they're always willing, open, and accepting of volunteers and mentors and resources from the community to help the work that they do.
And bringing things back around to Lincoln Hills. I mean, as you said, you were shocked in a good way when you heard this announcement yesterday. Are you hopeful that this will actually happen?
We are hopeful. We're hopeful because we know that this is happening because of the voices that have been amplified and have made it to the ears of the governor and the administration. It's been their cries for reform. It's been their vocal advocacy. It's been their calling legislators and calling the administration on behalf of young people and their families who have been in the system, who have been in Lincoln Hills and Copper Lakes and in the community, whose advocacy is really the cause of this change. And we are supportive of that, and we will continue to work with and build the capacity of of individuals and family members who are engaged in the system to build the capacity to be advocates for themselves and each other.
Jeffrey, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Jeffrey Roman, organizer for Youth Justice Milwaukee. He joins today to talk about Governor Walker's announcement of a proposed plan to close the Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake juvenile detention centers. For people buying insurance on the individual marketplace, the price of coverage can be a little hard to swallow, especially if they make too much to qualify for subsidies. Monthly premiums for some individuals can be so high that people are turning to drastic measures to get health insurance. And reporter Rachel Bluth of Kaiser Health News has been following some families that cut their income in order to get cheaper insurance. We talked to Rachel in December to learn more about the lengths people will go to defray the cost of their health insurance.
Well, you profile one person in particular dealing with this issue of medical expenses, Ann Cornwell of Tennessee. Can you tell us her story?
Yeah, so Ann Cornwell works for a really small consulting firm that doesn't offer any health insurance. So she, like a lot of other Americans, had to buy it on the individual market, and she saw that for her and her retired husband, it was going to come out to $2,100 a month this year for the least generous plan available. So she ended up reducing her hours. She was a full-time salaried employee, reduced her hours by 30%, became part-time, and took a huge pay cut in order to qualify for subsidies, so money from the federal government to help her purchase a plan on the individual market.
So she was in this place, and she's not alone. She's making a decent amount of money, too much to get subsidies under the Affordable Care Act. But without those subsidies in a lot of places, it's such a huge slice of income. People are in this bind now.
It is, yeah. You know, somewhere around 5 to 7% of people buy their insurance on the marketplace, and about half of those don't qualify for subsidies. So for Ann Cornwell, she took a $24,000 pay cut, but it was totally made up for because she got a $27,000 subsidy to buy insurance.
And she and her husband also talked about, as another option, getting divorced, right?
Yeah, they almost did. It's a little too hard to do that at the drop of the hat in Tennessee, where they're from. She thought about creating an LLC, like an individual corporation, and have it pay her a smaller salary so she'd be able to qualify, but that would have taken too long, too. So this was a pretty drastic step that she took, but it kind of highlights the fact that even with the subsidies and even with the Affordable Care Act, a lot of Americans still find health insurance pretty expensive.
And you talked to some financial planners for this story. What kinds of options did they lay out there for people in this income range? Too much to get subsidies, but then it's too expensive to buy this. What are some of the other options apart from drastic things like cutting back at your job?
Yeah, I think most people, most financial advisors probably wouldn't tell you to take a $24,000 pay cut, but there are some other options, you know, putting as much as you can into a 401k account or a health savings account, anything that will bring down your pre-tax income and maybe put that money away somewhere else so it's available to you later.
And is this a question that these financial planners you talk to are getting fairly frequently?
Absolutely. You know, buying health insurance is very complicated, especially with all the uncertainty around what was going to happen this year on the federal level with, you know, continuing the Affordable Care Act. So it really goes to show how it's really hard for people to navigate without a financial planner. The woman I talked to, Ann Cornwell, needed to go through four different spreadsheets to come to this conclusion.
And looking at the people in this situation and the kind of cutoff for subsidies, is it kind of tapered off? The less you make, the more subsidy you get, but at some point you just kind of fall off the cliff and there's no subsidy at all?
Yeah, so subsidies are available to people who fall between 100 and 400% of the federal poverty line. So for a family of two last year, that would have been a little bit more than $16,000 to around $64,000. So after that, you know, if you make $1 over, you're not qualifying for a subsidy.
And there have been increases in premiums in recent years, partly because of the Affordable Care Act itself, partly because of changes in the way the federal government has subsidized it. Is that making this more of a pressing problem?
So premiums go up every year because the cost of health care goes up every year. And there was some stuff at the federal level that might have contributed to increasing premiums this year. But subsidies go up with premiums. So if you're getting a subsidy and you see your premium going up, your subsidy will also go up. So that's why you're seeing this year, especially, a lot of people are able to buy with their subsidies these zero premium plans. They're called bronze plans. They're the least generous coverage available, but you'll be getting it for no premium every month. Actually, Anne Cornwell, the woman from my story, with her subsidy, even though the premium went up this year for her plan, she's not going to pay a premium every month because the subsidy went up as well.
Getting back to the people you're focusing on here, the people in that middle class range making a little too much to get subsidies, can't afford the premiums. Is anybody out there talking about a fix to that situation?
Not that I'm hearing. It's definitely something that a lot of people have to face. But you got to remember, most people who have health insurance aren't buying it on the individual market. You know, that's 5 to 7% of people. Most people get it from their employer or from the government. And so of that small percentage of people who buy it, an even smaller percentage aren't getting any subsidies. So it's a big problem for them, but it's a small percentage of people.
We'll leave it there for now. Rachel, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks, Rob.
Rachel Bluth is a reporter for Kaiser Health News. She joins us to talk about the length some families are going to get affordable health insurance on the individual marketplace. First, it's cold out, so it's a great time to work around a hot oven. Really hot. Our next guest says a lot of foods taste great when heated at 450 to 500 degrees. Vegetables, meat, pizza, you name it. Terry Milligan is a chef, culinary instructor, and food writer. You can follow her work in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel food section and in the food magazine Edible Door. Terry, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, I know over the years I've been kind of shy to heat stuff up too much, thinking I'm going to overcook it. How did you find your way to high heat cooking?
Well, it's kind of a fun way to get things done quickly because at the high heat, if you do it right, you can get even a roast chicken in just under an hour and have it be nice and crispy and still nice and moist inside if you do it the right way. And things like pizzas and vegetables really go quick, but could become caramelized in that high heat. Again, you got to kind of know the tricks to do it, but it works out great.
Right. The secret here is it's not just we do things at a higher heat and lower time and hope for the best, right? We actually got to think this out in advance.
It's best to have a plan.
Well, let's start with that chicken, roasting that chicken. I know people who have done this and swear by it. I usually do chicken, you know, breasts or something, just pieces. Mm-hmm. Talk about what we need to do to get that right, because I'd be worried about, great, I've got a chicken in there. I've cooked it really well on the outside and not enough on the inside.
That's right. That's why you've got to prep it correctly, and you've got to also obviously make sure you've got a nice chicken. So you start out with the best chicken that you can get. So a nice plump chicken, 4 to 5 pounds, has nice meat on it. If it's a free-range chicken, something like that would be even better. And you want to use about a 500-degree oven, actually. Then the trick is actually making sure that you have that chicken prepped right. So to get the crispy skin, you want to make sure that the outside skin is really dry. So what I tell folks to do is, you know, wash your chicken, pat it dry, but then let it set in the refrigerator for an hour or so and let the skin dry out, because that's where you get that crisp skin. Then to keep it moist on the inside, you want to make sure you truss it, which doesn't have to be fancy, just kind of tie in the legs, but make sure that you've got some aromatics inside. So put a piece of cut up orange and maybe some fresh herbs if you have them, and if not fresh, put in a lemon and a lime. But you need to have those little legs tied because you don't want the air to go through that little area there, because that's how you're going to dry out the meat, because you're getting the hot air going inside and outside. You just want it outside and then going in through the skin.
Now, if I was doing this, I think I would be paranoid around the appropriate cooking time. Like, I got to pull this out at just the right moment or it's going to get dried out and overdone.
Well, that's where you have your oven thermometer. So I always tell folks, if this is the first time they're doing it, check it at about 45 minutes in, just to double check to see where you're at. Because everybody, even though you have a know it's supposedly at 500 degrees, it might not be. And you want to make sure you have an oven thermometer kind of in there to make sure when you start cooking at high heat. But check between the leg and the thigh with your meat thermometer. And if it's really at 155, you can pull it out, because the chicken needs to rest about 10 to 15 minutes before you start carving it, and it'll cook another 5 minutes, so it'll get up to that 160, which is where you'd like chicken to be.
And you said between the leg and the thigh, because when I'm cooking a big piece of meat, I'm always like, where should I do it? Should I do it at the very thickest part? Does that mean I'm overcooking something else? So
yeah,
that's going to give us a good indication.
Want, just like a turkey, it's kind of between that leg and that thigh piece. And that's where you want to go. And you want to go just, you know, you don't want to go through and hit the little air pocket in the middle of the chicken. You want to go just like an inch or so in, so you're still hitting the meat. But that's where you want to go.
Now, for whatever we're cooking at this high heat, I talked to a person who does food science, was talking about baking, actually. He said, really preheat that oven and then preheat it extra so that the walls get warm, so that it's not
exactly
cooling too much when you every time you open the door. Are we doing the same thing here?
You are, and in fact, when I make pizza in a high heat oven, I actually put my pizza stone in the oven for an hour as it preheats. So the stone gets really, really hot. What you're trying to do is recreate those great open fires that you go to see at a pizza place, and it's, you know, they throw it in and 5 minutes it's done. We can't quite do that, but we can get close by heating up the pizza stone. Then once that hour is done, I use a pizza peel, the wood little peel that you would kind of push your pizza in right onto that hot stone. This is the trick. You turn the oven to broil for about 3 or 4 minutes. And you think that's crazy, but what it does is make that outside crust get that kind of blackened look, not burnt, but like those little blackened, oh, kind of bubbles. Makes it look like it was outside in a fire. Then you turn it back down to 500, and in about 10 to 12 minutes, your pizza's done. You're recreating it at home.
Great. We're talking to Terry Milligan. She's a chef and culinary instructor. We're talking about cooking stuff at high heat, higher than you might be used to, higher than I'm used to in some cases. Terry, I roast a lot of vegetables, especially, of course, in the winter, a pretty wide variety of them. And I did get that tip from our own Lori Skelton here at WPR to cook them hotter than I used to. And I got to say, it makes a huge difference. What is it? Why is it so much better?
Well, it brings out the natural sugars in the vegetables, especially root vegetables. So if you've done things like beets and carrots, you'll find that they get almost a caramelization on the outside. And that's because that high heat pulls out that sugar content. And then for things like Brussels sprouts, you get that like crispy little fluttery edge that, you know, everybody wants. So it's kind of very crispy on the outside but still cooked on the inside. So I think vegetables are great, root vegetables especially.
Give us some tips on preparing those root vegetables before they go in at that higher heat.
Well, one of the things that I have on my website is a recipe I did with carrots. And I did, instead of cutting the carrots into little pieces, I got full-sized carrots. If they're really thick, I'll cut them in half lengthwise. But otherwise, I put them in whole. And what's fun about that is you get a really beautiful presentation as well. And when you do the little pieces, they could cook too fast. But when you have those nice longer pieces, they're going to get still have a little crunchy kind of middle, but be really nice and roasted on the back. It's very beautiful.
Well, that's great, because I cut carrots into, you know, carrot sticks, julienne them or something like that, and most of them come out great. And then there's those skinny ones, because I'm not very careful about how to cut, and they're charcoal by the time it's done.
So you can kind of make them equal by, if you have some skinny and then some fat, cut those fat ones so they're all kind of equal proportions. And the other nice thing to do right now is, and these, a lot of stores now have rainbow carrots, so you can get yellow and purple and orange, and you can have just the picture I have on my site just shows this colorful array of carrots, and it was very simple preparation but so pretty.
We might hit some more in the vegetable family in a bit, but I want to get to some of the recipes you gave us. You got two, actually, that we've got at wpr.org/foodfriday. Let's go to cast iron roasted rosemary potatoes. This is in a cast iron skillet.
Correct. And cast iron is a great vehicle to use when roasting at high heat because it gets very even heat and it withstands the heat at high level. Sometimes you get pans and you have to be careful. It might say cannot go over 450 degrees. So a cast iron skillet, you have no problems going on high heat with.
So tell us about this potato recipe then.
So nice small potatoes. Look for those little new potatoes, red bliss potatoes, smaller Yukon golds. You can find little purple. I find even bags full of all three colors, which is great. All you're going to do is slice them in half and then toss them with some extra virgin olive oil. I like rosemary. Not everybody does, but you could use rosemary or oregano. A little coarse sea salt. Just kind of get that in a bowl and get them all covered. And then you put them cut side down in the hot pan. So you want that pan to get kind of hot before you put it in. And just let them roast about halfway through. It's going to take about 15 to 18 minutes. You can pop them on the other side just to get the other side cooked. But that side that was cut and on that hot pan, they're going to be perfectly roasted and crisp.
And with that oregano or rosemary, are we talking dry herb or the fresh stuff?
I prefer fresh, but it's not that easy in the wintertime. So you can certainly use dried. And what you have to remember is for every teaspoon of dried, it's going to be about a tablespoon of fresh. So if my recipe here calls for 2 tablespoons of fresh chopped rosemary, you'd use about 2 teaspoons of dried. So just know you're going to go down in the amount of dried versus fresh.
We're talking to Terry Milligan, a chef, culinary instructor, and food writer. She's with us to talk about high-heat cooking methods. If you can't stand the cold, get into the kitchen and cook at 450 to 500 degrees for a lot of this stuff. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you do this? Do you cook stuff at high heats? What are some of your favorite recipes to really crank that oven up for? Or do you have questions about how to do it, what to use, how to cook different kinds of things at higher heats? You can call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Chef Terry Milligan is with us on Food Friday. We're talking about high heat cooking with temperatures of 450 to 500 degrees in that oven. You can call in now to ask Terry your cooking questions. Do you have questions about cooking at higher heats? What you can do with it? Maybe what you can't do? What's the best thing you've made this way? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. To your calls now, David is with us in Slinger. David, hi.
Hello.
What do you want to ask about, David?
Well, I wanted to find out the best way to make crispy ham, for lack of a better term. We accidentally discovered this by basically burning our ham, but the part that wasn't burnt had a nice crispness to it. And if you burn it and you're not careful, you can also ruin your pan. So I'm imagining from what she was saying before that using cast iron might be a good way to go. But wondered if there were any suggestions about how to make crispy ham.
David, thanks. Terry, any ideas?
Well, I wondered if he was using a glaze of some sort to kind of get that ham crispy, because sometimes to get that that crispy crust on there, it's nice to put a glaze that has a little more sugar content, like a brown sugar Dijon mustard type glaze on top. And also to make sure if the ham has a lot of fat on it, you want to do that. It looks like a little diamond pattern. You want to do that so that fat kind of equally comes out on your ham and creates that nice crisp crust that he's looking for. So, I mean, that's kind of how I would do it, or how I do it to get that kind of crispy outside on a ham. But a glaze is pretty important to get that little kind of sugar content, because unlike a vegetable, you don't have that much of sugar content in there.
And how hot would we cook that ham then?
Well,
with
I
that
don't
glaze?
Know if I would go 500 yeah. on a ham. I mean, that's a little different. I probably would go a little bit more like a 400 or 375. I wouldn't go quite so high heat on it because you don't. That's got a pretty dense meat ratio versus a chicken that you've got kind of nothing in the middle there. So you want to make sure you get through the whole ham and not get it, as he said, burnt on the outside. You know, you want to make sure it's got a nice juicy interior.
David, thanks. Hope that helps recreate without charring most of the ham.
We don't want char.
No. Casey joins us next in Rice Lake. Casey, hi.
Hi. Yes, I have a question. I made a prime rib. Don't usually do prime ribs, but I did one for Christmas. And I did the heat the oven up to like 550, cook so much per pound, and then close the oven door, don't peek, 2 hours. And just wanted to know about, well, one thing, cookware, because you're right, that's probably cookware as far as
Casey, we're not hearing you too well, but I think I got the gist. Prime rib at a high temperature. She had read something about 550. She's wondering how to cook it and the cookware to cook it in, Terry.
Well, I think what she might be talking about is there's a way to cook rib roast and just a regular roast, too, where you cook at a very high temp, like a 500 to 550, but then you turn off the oven for 2 to 3 hours. So that it roasts in the oven, but you don't actually have it on. It kind of continues to go. So if you had a rib roast in there at 500 degrees, maybe a 6-pound roast, and you did it, turned it, got it into that hot oven, turned the oven off for about 2 hours without opening the door. You can't open the door because then you let that heat out.
Uh-huh.
In about 2 hours, you're going to have a medium rare piece of meat. So I'm thinking that's what she's talking about from what I could hear, that because I thought I heard her say then you turn the oven off. And that is a great way to do these roasts. So get that high heat, it gives it like a zing of crispiness. But then as the heat goes down, you're roasting that inside of the meat. And it works terrific on a rib roast or on just a regular beef roast. You just have to do some calculations on the pounds that you've got versus how many minutes you want to keep it in.
Casey, thanks a lot for calling. Hope that helps. We'll go next to Kate with us on Washington Island. Kate, hi.
Hello. Welcome. Why am I welcoming you? You should be welcoming me.
I welcome you, Kate.
Well, I welcome Washington Island. I know it's cold up there.
Yes, but it's fantastic, and it's a great time to roast up at really high heat. So I have a little restaurant up here. It's called Fiddler's Green, and I have an Unox and also a Turbo Chef. And I have been, and that's 500 degrees at 60 miles an hour, that Turbo Chef is. And I am roasting everything from radishes to beets, any roots. I heard you mention that. I'm like, I got to call in. I don't know why I'm calling. I'm just calling to say that I love roasting stuff at high heat.
And it comes out great.
I'm glad you said radishes, though. That's another great, you asked about, people forget about radishes. A high heat roasted radish is terrific.
What was that first piece of equipment? Oh, the radishes are okay, but what was that thing you said you made it in?
I've got two things. I've got an Unox, which is a, an oven that's made in Italy, and it's a combi. So it has the ability to do all sorts of different things, and then also a Turbo Chef, which is 500 degrees, and it's a convection, and it's 60 miles an hour.
Kate, thank you so much for sharing that. It sounds delicious, and Unox was that was new to me. But radishes, I don't even think about cooking with radishes usually, Terry. I just eat them raw, or I pickle them a little.
Well, I am working on a radish article right now, so that's why radishes are on my mind. And you can, they're great roasted with a little bit of sea salt on them. That's all you need, a little olive oil and sea salt. And because now you can get all these kind of unusual radishes, from watermelon radishes to French breakfast radishes, and the little red ones are just fine too, but there's a lot of radishes to select from.
Kate, thanks a lot for calling in at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Terry Milligan. She's a chef, a food writer. You can read her in the Journal Sentinel or Edible Door. We're talking about cooking at high heat, a lovely thing to do this cold stretch of year. Back to your calls now. Andy is on the line in Madison. Andy, hi.
Hi. I actually look forward to a cold snap every winter. We like to do thin crust pizzas, and instead of a pizza stone, I just went out and got basically unglazed tiles from like a home improvement store, and I just line the oven with them, and you got to heat them up for an hour at 500.
Yep.
And you can even go down to a pizza
thin crust pizza and just buy the dough from them.
Wow. So you make your own. Have you ever done that, Terry? I've never heard of people
well,
do that.
I've never done. I've heard of doing it where you can just buy, you know, you don't have to get a pizza stone, of course, as long as you get the right, as the caller said, the right
unglazed
type of, yes, you can't go down and you've got some leftover tiles from doing your living room. You don't want to use those. You just have to get the right ones, and that's a great way to do it. But as the caller said, heating that oven up to 500 for an hour, that's the way you get that really crisp crust.
Yum. Andy, thanks for calling. I want to get to the other recipe you gave us that we have at WPR.org/Food Friday, Terry. Cast iron skillet again, this one for roasted pork chops. Can you tell us about this?
Again, very simple. You've got the pork chops, some extra virgin olive oil, a little sea salt. I like cracked black pepper on it. And, again, I used fresh thyme, but you could use some dried. And I also like to put some whole garlic cloves, not the whole head of garlic, but some peeled garlic cloves and throw them in. And you get these little crispy garlic crunchies that go with the pork. So you do that, again, in a hot cast iron skillet. I usually start it on the burner, and then I pop it into the oven and flip it halfway through. It depends on how fat those chops are, but it'll probably take about 8 minutes for the whole thing to go. Then I pull it out, and any of those little juices that are left in that pan, I make a little sauce out of it with white wine. Just pour a little white wine in there, some mushrooms, and at the very end, swirl 2 tablespoons of cold unsalted butter in there, and you get a little wine sauce with mushrooms to go over it.
And you just spoon that over the pork chops when you serve it?
A little spoon sauce.
Well, that sounds really good, too.
And then you drink the rest of the wine.
And I wanted to bring up my favorite thing that I think the hottest thing I ever cook is usually cauliflower. That seems, for some reason, to work out really well at a higher temperature. I assume I read about it somewhere or heard about it from a Food Friday guest. What is it about cauliflower that works so well at high temperatures?
Well, I'm not quite sure what it is exactly, except that, you know, those vegetables do work so well in high heat. But, again, you can get those little crispy flowerettes, or you can do, I've done whole heads as well. And then you kind of cut it up like a steak. So for vegetarians, especially, that and vegans, that makes a great kind of entree to have a whole head of hot roasted cauliflower.
Oh, yeah, another recipe you have on your website, I didn't want to forget. It's a roasted tomato soup, so the hot oven part is pre-roasting those tomatoes, which I probably wouldn't have thought of.
Well, and I've got to tell you, that's one of the easiest soups in the world to make. You're putting those tomatoes in with a little bit of balsamic vinegar, and that brings out the sugar in the tomatoes. Then you basically put everything in a pot, and it's just stock the tomatoes. I used a little fresh basil at the end, but it's just pureed in a blender, and that's it. It took maybe 15 minutes total to make a nice big thing of soup.
Yeah, how long do these, are these little tomatoes or sliced up tomatoes?
I like to use a little round, like a teardrop or a baby, I'm losing what my concentration on what those are called. Teardrop.
Little
or
guys.
Cherry.
Cherry
tomatoes, yeah. And I use red ones, so I have nice red soup, but if those don't have a lot of seeds or water in them, you know, if you use those big tomatoes, they're just going to be, they're going to blow up and just be watery. But those little baby tomatoes, those will just become little kind of sugared tomato gems.
Well, Terry, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us again. I appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me.
That's Terry Milligan. She's a chef, a culinary instructor, and a food writer. You can follow her over at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's food section. She has a featured quarterly article in the food magazine Edible Door. That's like Door County. She joined us today to talk about high heat cooking, and you can find a couple of the recipes she shared today over at WPR.org/Food Friday. That pork chop one we were hearing about, and the potatoes, the rosemary potatoes, also in a cast iron skillet. While you're there, maybe share a recipe or a favorite of your own. Again, WPR.org/Food Friday to find a couple of Terry's recipes. There's some new math news of particular interest to a particular kind of nerd, like me. A crowdsourced project has discovered the largest known prime number. Quick refresher, a prime number is a number that can only be divided evenly by itself and 1. So you got 2, 3, 5, 7, 11, and 13 prime numbers. But 4, 6, 8, 9, and 10, for example, they are not. But forget these tiny little numbers. The new discovery is over 23 million digits long. So somebody was saying it would take 9,000 pages of a book just to type that number. I will now read the number on the air. Settle in. Okay, I'm not going to do that. This number was discovered by a FedEx employee, an engineer in Tennessee. He's participating in the Great Internet Mersenne Prime Search. That's a particular type of prime number, I guess. A little too much information about myself. I kind of like prime numbers. I tend to set alarms and microwaves. I shouldn't even admit this. I set them to prime numbers whenever I can. I have to stop and think it through. And then when I see numbers like a time or a number, and I got nothing better to do, I'll try to factor out in my head and see if it's a prime or not. I told my producers this earlier today, our producers on Central Time. They didn't really talk to me much about that after. They just kind of shook their heads. But they have their own little weird math habits too, they later admitted. This is Central Time, prime time, on the Ideas Network.